From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. People who are responding well to the new AIDS drugs are beginning to plan for the future instead of planning for death. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with photographer John Dugdale and psychotherapist Robert Levithan. Both are taking protease inhibitors. Their viral loads are down, their energy is up, and everything about their lives has changed. As Levithan says, they are outliving themselves. Also, need some suggestions for your holiday shopping list? Maureen Corrigan recommends some of her favorite books of the year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Authorities in New Orleans are working to shore up a section of a popular riverfront shopping complex today. A runaway freighter crashed into the Riverwalk on Saturday, injuring 140 people. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports from New Orleans.
Searchers are still sifting through the debris for possible victims, but city officials are optimistic no one was trapped inside the Riverwalk when the 70,000-ton MV Brightfield lost power and careened into the Wharfside building. New Orleans Fire Chief Warren McDaniels says searchers have been unable to reach parts of the collapsed two-tiered mall. Today, he says, workers will start removing debris to access those areas.
We're going to do this very slowly, very deliberately. The building is in a precarious position, and we're not going to rush it.
Right now, the 700-foot ship is moored along the Riverwalk, keeping the damaged structure from falling into the Mississippi River. As damage assessment and cleanup continues, the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard are investigating what caused the accident. Hearings will begin tomorrow. This is Debbie Elliott in New Orleans.
The White House is labeling as troubling the latest Israeli policy on settlements in the West Bank. White House spokesman Mike McCurry was asked about the decision by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to grant tax breaks and other financial benefits to Jewish settlers. McCurry told reporters they're complicating negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has denounced the move. An appeals court in South Korea has commuted the death sentence handed down to former President Chun Doo-hwan. It's reduced the prison term given to his successor. Charles Scanlon reports from Seoul.
The three-judge panel upheld all the guilty verdicts against the former presidents on an array of charges stemming from their violent seizure of power 16 years ago. But the judges decided to reduce the severity of the sentences in recognition of the former leader's contributions to economic development. South Korea enjoyed a spectacular economic boom in the 1980s during the authoritarian rule of the former generals. The judges said they were also taking into account the peaceful transfer of power in 1987, when Chun Doo-hwan stood aside in the face of mass demonstrations and allowed a free election. The decision to reduce the sentences will be a controversial one, even though few believe the death penalty would ever be carried out. For National Public Radio, this is Charles Scanlon in Seoul.
Shares of Boeing and McDonnell Douglas soared in early trading today on Wall Street. This comes a day after Boeing announced plans to buy its rival for more than $13 billion. Shares of McDonnell Douglas were up more than $12 each within the past hour. Boeing stock rose nearly $6 a share. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 30 points in moderate trading of 179 million shares. This is NPR News. A small plane crashed into a house in Birmingham, Alabama today, killing all three people aboard the aircraft. The twin-engine plane went down shortly after taking off from the Birmingham airport. Witnesses say the plane seemed to wobble as it flew low over the city's downtown area, narrowly missing the 30-story Bell South Tower. All seven people inside the house got out safely. Senator Dan Coats of Indiana, a conservative Republican, will not seek re-election in 1998. Coates said today he wants to leave the Senate young enough to pursue a career outside of government. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Coates was expected to challenge moderate Republican Jim Jeffords for the chairmanship of the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee this year, but decided against it. At the time, it was thought that he wanted to devote his energy to his re-election bid. But today, Coates announced he will retire from the Senate at the end of his term. The 53-year-old says he wants to leave office while he's young enough to contribute somewhere else. Indiana's Governor Evan Bayh, a Democrat who leaves office after his maximum two terms, was expected to challenge Coates for the seat. Coates said that challenge didn't worry him, but that campaigning would require a single-minded two-year devotion. His retirement announcement, he says, will give other Republican candidates time to prepare. Coates first was appointed to the Senate to fill the seat of Dan Quayle when he became vice president. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Supreme Court issued a ruling today on after-school Bible clubs. The nation's high court rejected an appeal by a school district on Long Island. In effect, the ruling allows such clubs to require their officers to be Christians. School officials argued the requirement discriminates against non-Christians. The Supreme Court ruled the Walking on Water Student Christian Fellowship has a First Amendment right to set its own rules. I'm Dave Mattingly, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publisher of The Christmas Mystery, a holiday tale by Yostein Garter, author of Sophie's World. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New AIDS drugs are giving some people a chance to plan for the future instead of planning for death. I say some people because many people don't respond to the drugs or can't tolerate the side effects, and many can't afford them. My guests today have been taking these new drugs, known as protease inhibitors, and have responded well. The chance of a longer life is changing everything for them, physically, psychologically, emotionally. My guest Robert Levithan is a psychotherapist who's dealing with the hope and uncertainty offered by these new drugs in his life and in the lives of his clients. John Dugdale is a photographer who is continuing to work in spite of the fact that AIDS-related illnesses robbed him of 75% of his vision. You may have seen some of his extraordinary photos in a recent New York Times Magazine article called When AIDS Ends by Andrew Sullivan. I asked Robert Levithan and John Dugdale to describe the impact of the new drugs on their health. Here's Levithan's response.
There hasn't been a radical change in my health. What has happened is two things. One is that my blood work shows an extraordinary reversal from going from having 20 T cells when I went on a protease inhibitor after winning a lottery for access to it in October of 1995. My T cell count then was 20. Under 200 allows for one to have an AIDS diagnosis. It's considered a marker for that. Over 500 is beginning of the range of normal. Most people have 1,200, 1,500, somewhere up there. I now have a T-cell count of 400, over 400. This is brand new territory in the sense that there used to be the picture of people going down. We've never really dealt with people's immune systems rebuilding. And I don't even think that we knew that when people went on protease inhibitors and the life of the virus, the viral load in one's body was inhibited, perhaps even eliminated for periods of time, that immune systems would rebuild. So I'm left with this new situation of having better blood work, a little bit more energy, and just an awareness that I feel like I have a safety net. I have an immune system. And so psychologically and emotionally, I feel safer.
John Dugdale, what about you? How has your health changed?
Well, I've had a bit of a more dramatic effect from HIV, and my T-cell count had went all the way down to zero, and it had stayed there for almost 6 years and led up to, finally, to a stroke and to a rampant case of CMV retinitis, which took away about three-quarters of my sight. And my doctor had repeatedly said, you know, never to really, once you hit zero, don't worry about that anymore. You know, we were just encouraged to not think about it. So when I started taking the protease inhibitors, I didn't really have any great expectations and I was amazed to watch my T-cell count go from 0 to 75 to 100, 250 to 210, which is where it is now, which means that I'm above the CDC definition for having AIDS or not having AIDS. So it's been a really dramatic change. And my energy level is completely different than when I had zero T cells. I can jump out of bed in the morning and I have lots of energy to lead a normal day. And it feels remarkable. I had forgotten how good it feels to get a good night's sleep and just jump up and do your work.
John, what is the regimen of pills you have to take?
Oh, every 8 hours I have to take 6 pills. And you have to take them on an empty stomach, which totally changes your eating schedule. You have to plan your day around having an empty stomach. You know, for some part of the day, you can't eat for 2 hours and you can't eat for an hour afterwards. But it's caused a lot of problems and trauma with some of my friends that are taking it. But it's kind of a nice way to regiment the day. If, you know, since we have to do it, it's good to make it into a pleasant task.
Robert, is the regimen okay with you?
It's not too bad for me. I have come to approach it almost like a discipline, like chanting or meditation or something is the way it has come to work for me. I'm good at discipline of this sort. And yet every once in a while, I'm just aware that I am timing my meals, my social events and interactions around the schedule. And it can be feeling inconvenient, and it's really, you have to get creative when you change time zones.
What happens if you, forget to take a pill?
I've never done that. I'm too obsessive about this. There's the theory that there's you might open a window for the virus to have a little chance to come back, gain strength, and it's probably like anything else, not that big a deal.
I've just forgotten on occasion, completely just slips my mind. I get involved in taking a photograph or something, and then it's 6 or 8 hours later. So I've taken to having an alarm that beeps quietly. That reminds me sort of where I am in the day. I wake up in the, you know, around 1 o'clock in the morning with this alarm and keep the medication near my bed so that I can have it on an empty stomach and not change my schedule too much. So it really does change your life. It structures it in a very specific way.
John, you had been pretty sick before taking the protease inhibitors. How much time did you think you had left before you started the new drugs?
I actually thought I had arrived at my end point and did a tremendous amount of mental gymnastics to become all right with that feeling. And I actually embraced it and I felt quite comfortable with it. And I had done a lot of healing with my family and friends and with what I had accomplished in my life. So I really didn't have any investment exactly in my future, except, you know, I was proud of what I had done already and really stopped wrangling with whether or not I was going to be here. So this whole thing is a bit of a surprise.
And what were the mental gymnastics that you said you were going through in order to accept that?
Sure. I had a stroke, strangely enough. I'm a very healthy person. And the first thing people say when they hear I had a stroke is, oh, you're so young. And they didn't know that it was a stroke at first. So I spent 3 weeks in the hospital, sort of paralyzed on one side and my whole body kind of going berserk. And I have been lucky in my life that most of the things that I've tried to do have been somewhat of a success, and I've always been able to accomplish what I set out to. And having a stroke and not being able to move and not knowing what it was and thinking that I was potentially going to die soon didn't sort of compute. I didn't finish painting my house. I didn't take enough pictures. I didn't have just the right love affair. I did just so much that I wanted to accomplish, and I really wrestled with that. And wrestled with it, kept me up all night. I couldn't stop talking. I was completely freaked out. And then one day, I was so exhausted from freaking out, I just relaxed. And I just, the whole thing flip-flopped over to the other side. And I realized that I had done a tremendous amount in my life. I was very proud of my unpainted farmhouse. And I was really excited to be able to leave behind the small body of photographs that I had done. I didn't know that I was going to make the best work of my life, you know, shortly after getting out of the hospital.
Robert, how much time did you think you had left before you went on the new drugs?
Well, I had been a year and a half before I went on these. I had been very ill with two kinds of pneumonia, and I did come as close as I've ever come to death, and it shook me up, and I had to stop working, and I had months of convalescence. But some irrational part of myself never thought that it was over. From the moment I discovered my immune system was depleted, I was just looking for the way I could build it up. And I had been going to many different sources, alternative medicines, experimental treatments. And I'm very privileged because I had the financial wherewithal and the connections to be able to seek out almost anything that existed. And I had tried a number of things, and nothing had worked up until then. And I think I had just reached a point where I was starting to wonder if other people were right who had treated me as if I were slightly delusional. when along came the protease inhibitor and this lottery, which I applied for and won, and exactly what I had envisioned 2 years earlier was possible started to happen. And much to my surprise, here I am. I just, saying earlier to John, a couple days ago, I was riding down in the elevator from my apartment, and I had one of those moments when it just flashed on me that, wow, I'm alive. I don't think I even expected to be here today. And all of my worries about relationships and money and career and everything that I've gotten wrapped up in again dropped away, and I was ecstatic by the fact that I was alive. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and I was able to walk down Bleecker Street and be aware of the ecstasy of simply breathing, walking, feeling good. And I don't know if I remembered that before I was ill and have had this chance to outlive myself.
Robert, what do you think your life expectancy is now?
Aha, very good question. I think I'm working with a 10-year plan with renewable options of another 10, 20, or 30, or 40. I come from a family of long livers, and I somehow expect that I had said at one point years ago, if I can make 40, I can make 90. And now I'm 45. And that's really a possibility. Sometimes it's a bit scary because it means I have to behave like a grown-up. When I thought I was dying, I could spend all my money and live out some of my fantasies without worrying about the long-term costs or depleting my resources. And now I have that incredible balance. It's not about going back to the way it was. That's so important. I don't think we can or is it even desirable. The things I've gotten out of this long relationship with my mortality, I've known I've been HIV positive for over a decade, is that, and then, you know, the actual illness and coming close to death, is that I am less likely to get caught up in the day-to-day things. I felt a great sadness when I was regaining my strength at each sort of threshold coming back from illness at the fact that I saw the day-to-day problems or whatever you might want to call them coming back in, you know, financial ones and different ones, and thinking, ah, gee, I have to deal with that. And when I have that, the moments when I'm just grateful to be alive, all of that stuff drops away.
Robert, you said when you were sick, you could behave more like a child and spend all your money and try to live out your fantasies, you know, in the brief life that you had left. When you got better, did you have any infrastructure left in your life, a savings account, a home,
yes,
a job?
I did, but some people don't. I always was holding out the idea that I might just be around, so I never went wild that way. This is the big issue, though, in our community. I do seminars called Outliving Ourselves, and a lot of the people show up. It's because they were told they had 2 years to live, and now it's 8 years later, 10 years later, and they have sold their insurance, quit their jobs. Their lives don't work if they're going to be around, and they're sitting here healthy. And a lot of this happened before protease inhibitors, but it's certainly been up the ante. And so that there are a number of people who, yes, it's how to go back and create a life, or go forward and create a life, really, that works for us. And it's never about going back before AIDS. It's just about incorporating this in our lives and all of that we've learned from it, all the gifts, the things we actually can be grateful to. For a lot of people, it's been a wake-up call. And it's given us insight into our relationship to living, because we've had to face death. I mean, everyone's going to die. You know, hello. It seems to be the great denial in our culture.
John, did you have a personal infrastructure left when you started to get a little better?
Yes, I did. And it's actually the thing that I focused on to get myself up and back on my feet and learn how to walk again and get back into what I was doing. I was lucky also, and also I had worked very hard and had lots of money that was still, when I was struck down with that dumb stroke, I had been working, and enough money came in while I was sick to keep my mortgage paid and keep my rent paid, and I'm real glad that those things were there, because it really gave me something to meditate on, and I would sort of go around the property at my farmhouse and put each post in my mind and work on my fencing and repair the barn. And, you know, it really gave me something to work towards.
Robert, what are some of the long-term issues that you gave up worrying about that now you're faced with again?
Well, I would say I never really gave up all of them except for a brief moment there when I was...
You're a conscientious guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, since I've had this long-term relationship with HIV, I'm one of those folks who, you know, since I went back to graduate school when I was 37 and spent 4 years getting a master's in... as a psychotherapist, because I had started creating support groups and working with people to create support groups that matched what I was looking for. And so I found my life work within the AIDS community, although I'm happy to say that all my clients are not don't have HIV or AIDS. And I, you know, because underneath the issues are all the same issues. And that's what's happened with the protease inhibitors. That's what I find in the Outliving Ourselves workshops or the seminars that I've been doing, is that the bottom line issues are attachment, fear of the future, fear of life, fear of death. It's all the issues that everyone has. They've just gotten focused by HIV and now in some ways brought into a new focus.
If you're just joining us, my guests are photographer John Dugdale and psychotherapist Robert Levithan. They're both living with AIDS, but they're both on the new drugs, the protease inhibitors, and those protease inhibitors have boosted their immune systems and they're much healthier now than they were before taking the new drugs. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with psychotherapist Robert Levithan and photographer John Dugdale. They're both living with AIDS, but they're both on the new drugs, the protease inhibitors, which have boosted their immune systems. I'm wondering if being healthier now is changing your relationships to friends and to current or former lovers. And if I may be blunt, here's what I'm thinking. Sometimes when you know somebody's very sick or when you assume they're close to death, you forgive them everything, you know, and there's just, you just find all the sweetness in the relationship, all the sweetness in that person. But, you know, if the person isn't near death, those little irritants might rise back to the surface again, and you're back to just, you know, day-to-day life, the ups and downs of day-to-day life, the ups and downs of day-to-day relationships. Robert, what's your experience been?
Well, part of me just want to say yes. It hasn't changed things that much for me, I don't think. I think illness allowed me to focus on which of my relationships were nurturing and which ones perhaps weren't. Mm-hmm. You do get the wonderful surprise that people show up you don't expect, and some people can't be around illness. And it's not a right or wrong thing. It's just we all have what we're capable of doing. I have been overwhelmed with the amount of support and love I have in my life. One of the things being ill has allowed me to do is to stop and receive. I am a caregiver by temperament and by profession now, and it was very hard for me to accept that I didn't have to do something for people to give things to me. And suddenly being in a position where I couldn't do anything for anyone except be there, I discovered that people loved me and were willing to support me in that period of my life. And they're still there. And I don't have to be... That's one of the attachments of illness. I sort of go back to a question, is that if I was caught in the trap where if I start defining myself as healthy again, which I have, I had a fear come up that I would lose this love and support that I had gotten because I had never allowed it in until I was ill. And I have not seen it disappear as I redefine myself as healthy. However, it is still like a little question mark.
Mm-hmm. I had a very similar experience to Robert. And when I was in the hospital, I found myself having to comfort friends and relatives and that I would take care of them when they came to see me, which was a big surprise. And I have a really large circle of friends and acquaintances, and it was very interesting to watch which ones sort of rose up to the surface. A handful became valiant sort of support, you know, support team members and helped me through that crisis on a daily bases, and other people fled in the opposite direction. And like Robert said, it's not because they were wrong to do that. They just can't. Some people can't really face that. And it was also a shock to me to realize that being so ill, I was taking care of the people who came to see me because they were so frightened. They'd come to the AIDS floor at St. Vincent's on 7th Avenue in downtown Manhattan, and they would pull the curtain back slowly and peer around to see what I look like, and they were just terrified. And I, you know, because most of the things that I had were on the inside, no matter how sick I was, it didn't particularly show on the outside, and they were always relieved, and they'd think, oh, wow, gosh, you're not that sick after all. And that was always a startling feeling.
Now that you're not sick and that you're in better health than you were, how much time do you spend, how much time do you want to spend taking care of other friends who are sick? I would imagine you both still have friends who are sick.
Oh, sure.
Yes.
I have a wonderful friend named John who I called up this morning to invite to have tea at my studio on tomorrow. And he's, you know, this disease is still very erratic, and he was fine on Monday, and today he's getting ready to go into the hospital being very, very sick. And I sat down on the floor with the phone, and I just tried to infuse him with as much positive input as I could and make myself available for him, because I understand his fear so clearly, and even though it was 3 years ago, it's so fresh in my mind that I really feel compelled to give back that way and to share whatever strength that I was able to muster up and the things that I had learned with whoever reaches out. And I'm looking forward to going to see him in the hospital tomorrow and making sure that he's in a safe place in his head.
How do you feel about going back to the hospital?
Oh, it's overwhelming. Sometimes just the smell or the quality of the light there can make me feel faint, kind of. And when I was there, I tried very much to, I was there for a half of a year, and I tried very much to make it my own space. I brought in all my own linens from home, I redecorated the apartment, I changed the lighting, I rearranged the room, and actually made a safe place for myself there. But there's an energy in the hospital that's really hard to eradicate completely, and I have to steel myself up before I go in and sort of like not let it affect me.
Do you realize you called your hospital room an apartment? You said redecorate the apartment.
Did I really? Yeah. Well, you know what? That's where my head was. And I think that's one of the things that really helped me to have such a successful time there. Made friends with the nurses. They, you know, we had pizza parties in my room and really made it, tried to give it as much normalcy as possible, because it is such a jarring experience. So I tried to go and be there for my friends so that they can have a little bit of that as well.
John Dugdale and Robert Levithan will be back in the second half of the show to tell us more about how the new AIDS drugs are changing their lives. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Diane Ackerman's A Slender Thread, Rediscovering Hope at the Heart of Crisis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Back to Life. We continue our conversation with Robert Levithan and John Dugdale about their experiences with the new AIDS drugs. And critic Maureen Carrigan recommends some of her favorite books of the year as holiday gifts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with psychotherapist Robert Levithan and photographer John Dugdale. They both are living with AIDS, but have responded well to the new AIDS drugs known as protease inhibitors. As they told us in the first part of the show, these new drugs are changing just about every aspect of their lives. Have your family relations changed?
Well, when I was at my sickest in the hospital, this is going to sound so simplistic, but one of the things that never dawned on me is that if you're going to die, you have to say goodbye to your friends and your family. And I was like, I thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to be able to say goodbye to my mother and my sister and my brother? And we drew together so closely around that issue, and every night was an incredibly powerful group hug and a nuzzle. And, you know, you just never realize how precious your relationships are until you're faced with having to let go of them.
And have you kept that closeness now that you're feeling better?
Yes, I have. I have to say my sister and my brother are my best friends, and it's kind of a rarity. I don't see that in a lot of my friends, but we bonded so closely. We were always close, but we sort of merged together in the hospital, and we haven't come unglued since then. I really am thrilled about that.
And Robert, what about you?
I would say that it's not quite as dramatic as John's experience. However, we've gotten closer. Only 6 months before I was very, very ill, my mother died, and she'd been ill for a while. So that process had brought my two brothers and my father and my sisters-in-law and I much closer. And I think my illness was a continuation of the process. And there's a way in which a lot of the barriers dropped away. And if I ever, ever doubted that people were there for me in my family, and not just my immediate family, I have uncles and cousins and people who are just extraordinarily there for me, I had the visible proof that I will never, ever be abandoned or have to worry about certain issues that way. Mm-hmm.
I imagine that you both have friends who have AIDS but are unable, for whatever reason, to take protease inhibitors or because of the side effects, or maybe they're too sick to take it, whatever. Is there a rift now between people you know who are on the new drugs and who are getting better and feeling healthier, and those who can't take them or who don't respond to them and are getting sicker and closer to death?
I actually have been on both sides of the coin. When I started my first group of antivirals, they worked briefly and then stopped working. And I go to a wonderful large support meeting every Monday, and I heard people around me saying how successful they were and how their T cells were zooming, and I had the most mixed feelings. I was so happy for them, and I wanted to bash them in the head with something because I just didn't understand why it wasn't working for me, and I felt very, very left out. And I did feel angry, and I sort of thought, well, what is all this excitement about? It's not working for everyone. And then I changed my combination of drugs, and suddenly my T cells started to soar. So I can kind of see it from both sides of the coin. I don't think that there's a physical rift between people. I think we're all trying to support each other. I mean, that's been my experience.
I have been more on the only on the side where it's been working for me, and I know that when I first brought it up in these support groups at this wonderful place where we both attend groups, Friends Indeed, that I was hesitant because I was afraid that what is good news for me might be painful for other people. But then I also realized that if I didn't bring it forward or somebody didn't bring it forward, people who were looking for hope wouldn't have this to latch on to know that it's possible. So the first thing is that there's this possibility that didn't exist, which can be very hopeful for people and create, you know, a sense of the potential for what may be achieved with what exists today and or with what's coming along, you know, if we can hold out.
I just want to add also that I think it's really important that people understand that for most of the people who have experienced AIDS in any way, shape, or form, it'll never be over completely. I consider myself like a Civil War veteran or something. No matter how healthy I get, my sight will never return unless something incredibly dramatic happens with, you know, retinology. But Every waking moment of my life, I'm reminded that I was very sick and that my life will never be the same. And I get a little aggravated when people just think that it'll be, oh, it's all over now. You know, it's all finished. Just like the veterans that you see marching in the parade from the Great Wars every year still, you know, it doesn't go away just like that. It just becomes quieter.
Well, another reason why it's not all over, a lot of people can't take the drugs or don't respond to the drugs.
Mm-hmm. Or do not have access to them.
Right, or don't even have a glass of water to take them with. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a very small community that are really benefiting from this. You know, in Africa, they'll be happy to have the clean, fresh water even to drink them with, and then how on earth will they ever be able to regulate taking 6 pills every 8 hours. It's a very small tip of the iceberg, I feel, that's benefiting so far from these drugs, which I really feel should be free. It's really incenses me to realize what they cost.
What do they cost?
A lot. Robert, do you have any idea?
I think the protease protocols themselves, which are used in combination with other drugs, but just the protease are anywhere, I think, $15,000 to $20,000 a year.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm at least a $50,000 a year operation just to, you know, stay alive.
Yes, my hospital stay costs $320,000, you know, and it seems to be, healthcare stuff like that seems to be spiraling out of control. And it's a frightening aspect of all of this.
Do you both have health insurance?
I do.
I didn't when I went in the hospital, and I relied on public assistance. And I do now, you know, after getting everything lined up and getting back on my feet, I do also.
You must be living with a lot of uncertainty. The new drugs that you're on have only been used for, I think, about a year. So there is no such thing as a long-term understanding of how these drugs work or how long they work. How are you dealing with the uncertainty of not really knowing how long the drugs will be effective in keeping the virus at bay?
Yeah, I don't think about it on a day-to-day basis. I really don't. I just approach each day as an individual thing and go ahead and take my viral stuff and see what happens. It hasn't been a year yet that I've been taking it. That's, you know, that's very young. We're really at the forefront of this. We're kind of the pioneers. We're the first batch of people who have been successfully treated for HIV. And I think it's just going to get better and better. I really do. There are things coming down the pike that are more powerful, easier to take. You know, they're just going to refine it. I kind of feel like a good guinea pig for my, you know, brothers and sisters in the future who are going to have to deal with this.
Robert, how do you deal with the uncertainty?
Well, I think it hasn't changed in a certain way. I know that when my T-cell count was first going up, I hit this moment and I noticed an anxiety. And I was thinking, what's my anxiety? And a good friend said, something's going on for you. And then I went, oh, I see. I suddenly had this fear that I wouldn't have the strength to handle a downward spiral again. Because here, I never expected to be in this position again. Then it was like, oh, I have something to lose again. And then I had to get to that place in me where I went, I've lived through the last 10 years. I can live through whatever's going to show up next. You know, there's no point in my going to how can I handle these things and worrying about them. I have the resources because I've already lived through so much that I'll get through whatever shows up. I know that about myself. And, you know, yes, maybe this is just the equivalent of a remission, but it's a great thing. I might as well enjoy. I have to enjoy the time now.
My guests are psychotherapist Robert Levithan and photographer John Dugdale. They're both living with AIDS, but have responded very well to the new AIDS drugs known as protease inhibitors. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Robert Levithan and John Dugdale. Robert is a psychotherapist. John is a photographer. They're both living with AIDS, but they're both on the new drugs, the protease inhibitors, and are doing quite well on those drugs. Their immune systems have been strengthened, and they're feeling considerably better than they were before. What I'd like to do is spend a few minutes talking with each of you about how your work has been affected by AIDS. And Robert, let me take a couple of minutes first with you. You're a psychotherapist. Are most of your clients people who have AIDS?
A large number of them. I work at Friends Indeed as a crisis counselor and a group leader. And so they are, most of my clients are HIV positive or dealing with AIDS, although I have several clients there who aren't, because more and more people are coming to our groups who are either dealing with cancer or another illness, or who just appreciate the fact that we're dealing with how to live the rest of our lives, the quality of our lives, as opposed to the length of our lives.
So that carries over even for people who aren't sick?
Yes, absolutely. And I noticed that I in my private practice, I have some clients who have no relationship to AIDS particularly, and the issues are often the same. Or the other fact is, though, sometimes it's nice to take a break from it. And mm-hmm. I'm glad. I've made a commitment to myself that all of my professional life would not ever be completely centered around AIDS, because I'd like to have breaks from it. Also, I have made sure that I did not want to have an investment in AIDS sticking around.
Mm-hmm. Now, John Dugdale, you're a photographer, and your photographs were featured in the New York Times Magazine article not too long ago that Andrew Sullivan wrote about AIDS and the new protease inhibitors. And you also have a gallery show currently up in New York. Now, you lost about 3/4 of your eyesight when you suffered a stroke as a result of AIDS. And yet the photographs you're taking now are really quite extraordinary. They're very highly composed. The lighting is really subtle and atmospheric. And I'm wondering the same thing I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, is how do you manage to take such interesting, well-composed photographs when you can barely see?
Let's see. Yesterday at the gallery, I gave a class about 25 blind and visually handicapped photographers who were taking a class at one of the big schools here. And I had the opportunity to speak with them about that all afternoon. And it's very simple. I've been doing this for almost 20 years, and I'm intimately familiar with my surroundings and the objects that I own and the people who come into my life. I get to know as friends. And then when I do a portrait of somebody or do a still life, I'm working with a sense memory of what I know it looks like. You know, it's not that mysterious. You know, there are lots of tricks. I work with a large format camera, an 8x10 camera, so that I can compose in big blocky shapes that are totally blurry through the back of the camera. I can wrestle the camera into the space that I wanted, and I ask a lot of questions. Happily, I'm a very good director, and I can... All of my family know now how to use my camera from 1912, which is really fun to see my brother, you know, working with it. And I can just shout directions to them. A lot of times I'm in the picture myself because they become very diaristic. Does that explain a little bit? It's not
still
a mystery.
I'm wondering
how
you, for instance, control the lighting. I mean, lighting is very subtle in your photographs.
Yeah, it's nothing. God does the lighting. It's just light coming through windows or light flooding across a field. I don't really, you know, there's not any big, there's not sort of a trick, or there's not a real there's not a secret to doing lighting like that. You just have to look. And the startling thing that I found in working with people with the camera is that people who have 20/20 vision, they don't use their sight quite as much as I want them to. They don't look at what they're seeing. And I spent years as an art student studying great paintings and the history of photography, and now I'm drawing on those mental pictures that I have to compose and to light these pictures. But it's just really about noticing what's around you.
Before you lost so much of your vision, you were a commercial photographer. I think you did a lot of ads for a lot of photographs for advertising campaigns.
Yes, I did.
And now you're not doing that anymore. Now you're doing what we describe as art photographs.
That's the great gift that AIDS has given me, is that it allowed me to step out and have the confidence to do exactly what I had set out to do in the first place. The commercial career was a sort of a sidetrack that I never meant to get on, but suddenly I found myself deeply involved in, you know, 40 hours a week of photographing shoes and pocketbooks and dishes of spaghetti and just about anything else that my agent got for me. And it left me tired out and not wanting to touch the camera. I needed to rest on the weekends. Then, you know, when that went away, the commercial clients really fled in the opposite direction. They don't like any kind of disability. And it was really the best thing that could have happened to me. I stepped out of the hospital not knowing what was going to happen. My sight was actively leaving. It was, you know, it's like a curtain drawing slowly across my eyes. And I presented a show to my friends John and Billy at my gallery, and an idea for a show, and I never expected them to be so interested in it. And they said, yes, you know, go ahead, why don't you do it? And I said, okay, maybe next year. And they said, no, in the next 6 weeks. And then that started the ball rolling, and I found that my worries about my sight and about my illness fell by the wayside, and the most important thing came to be that show, which was called Lengthening Shadows Before Nightfall. And yeah, I'm very happy about it all.
One of your photographs, and this photograph our listeners may have seen because it was reprinted in the New York Times Magazine, is of you being embraced by your mother, and your mother has,
yes,
like long gray hair, which is wrapped around you. It's a beautiful, it's a really moving photograph, and I'm wondering about how you got the idea for the photograph and how you executed it.
What I did with a lot of the sort of grim things like seizures and all the testing and all the sort of difficult things that happened to me in the hospital, in my mind and on a piece of paper, I had a little book, I kept a journal, and I thought that one way that I could own the things and make them special is to get out of the hospital and reinterpret them in the most beautiful way that I could through, you know, recasting the people that were there with me during things like my first eye surgery and, you know, just recasting them in a beautiful way to get the emotion and the beauty of the powerful support that I was getting at the time. And my mother was so clearly there for me with every bit of her soul. When we got out of the hospital, I photographed everyone that had spent time with me, and I got together with my mother, and we spent an afternoon with my sister and brother, and did a various poses of us together and her holding my hand and sitting together on a table. And she was exhausted and I was kind of tired also. And the shooting was finished and my mother said, oh, I'm tired. She said, put your head on my shoulder, honey. And I put my head down on her shoulder and my sister said, don't move, don't move. And she ran and got one more piece of film and took that picture. And I really feel like it's been the pinnacle of my photographic career so far. And I treasure that picture. It's so powerful for me.
How do you see that picture?
I can't see the things when they're happening, but what I do when the film comes back from the lab, I have a series of very strong magnifying glasses that I can examine. I have a little bit of peripheral sight in my left eye, and I'm able to, if I use a very strong glass, I can see what, you know, the contact. When the picture came back of my mother and I, it didn't seem like it happened because I wasn't taking the picture. I was in the picture, and I was so startled when I saw my mother and I that I dropped the contact print on the table, and I had to look away for a moment and then look back. It was so strong. So it's a way that I use a photography in a way to see, because people come to the studio to have their portrait done. I never know what they look like when they're there. I can't focus on them at all, and I go through all the motions and set the whole thing up, and I've been making wonderful new friends and meeting people by photographing them and then studying them in the photographs when they come back with my magnifying glass.
John Dugdale, I'd like to bring Robert Levithan just back into the conversation briefly.
Terrific.
And ask you each if there's any concluding thoughts you have in the few seconds that we have remaining.
Well, I guess it's that this is an amazing... everything that comes to my mind sounds like a cliche, but, you know, an adventure. I've been, you know, John is a diarist. I'm documenting my journey in a book called Outliving Myself, because I keep discovering new layers of my emotional experience, my psychological experience, as I face the next unknown obstacle, hurdle, or discovery, you know, miracle in my life, too, miracles that show up. So it's just... it's fascinating. I'm having a good time if I remember to just watch and observe that my life, first of all, I didn't know I'd even be here today. So everything is a miracle. And that awareness, I hope, will stay with me for the rest of my life, however long it is.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having us.
Robert Levithan is a psychotherapist based in New York. John Dugdale is a photographer. He has an exhibition of work from the past year at the Wessel O'Connor Gallery in Manhattan. Coming up, our book critic picks the best books of the year. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has made a list and checked it twice, so she's confident she can recommend her picks for the best books of the year for your own holiday shopping list.
I've spent 1996 the same way I've happily spent much of my adult life, reading, reviewing, and teaching hundreds of good books. Yet one book published this year soars above the literary swarm. That's Frank McCourt's memoir, Angela's Ashes. As McCourt acknowledges, his childhood contained the standard stuff of every Irish hard luck story, from Joyce's Portrait of the Artist to Betty Smith's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. The shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother, pompous priests, and bullying schoolmasters. Indeed, a writer would need the pluck of a Jimmy Cagney and the dramatic gifts of a Sean O'Casey to make such rusty material shine again. Luckily, McCourt has both. Angela's Ashes deserves to be enshrined in the library of Irish great books, a couple of shelves below the Book of Kells. Speaking of great books, David Denby's tome of the same name makes its own claim on that superlative. In Great Books, Denby describes the exhilarating and exhausting year he spent as a returning student at Columbia University. Denby graduated nearly 30 years ago, but he wanted to retake two core curriculum courses and thus stake out his own position on the relevancy of the Western canon. By doing what few of the canon's champions or detractors have done, that is, reading a respectable chunk of it, Denby casts a wondering eye on the soul-enriching complexity and, yes, radicalness of Aristotle, Shakespeare, and other enduring writers. Some of the great books Denby discusses, like Homer's Odyssey, were originally oral works recited by generations of poet performers before they were written down. In a wonderful collection entitled Committed to Memory, editor John Hollander and a committee of fellow poets have chosen what they consider to be the 100 best poems in English to learn by heart. Among the old favorites here are Emily Dickinson's Because I Could Not Stop for Death and Ernest Lawrence Thayer's Casey at the Bat. The collection also spotlights lesser-known poems, including Robert Hayden's moving reflection on a strained father-son relationship called Those Winter Sundays. The first stanza reads, "Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold, then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him." Michael Berube's remarkable book, Life as We Know It, focuses on his own experience of being a father to his son Jamie, who was born with Down syndrome. Berube, who's previously made a name for himself as an all-too-rare, readable literary theorist, interweaves his account of Jamie's first 3 years with in-depth discussions of the ethics of prenatal and IQ testing. Individual humans like James, says Berube, are compelling us daily to determine what kind of individuality we will value, on what terms, and why. The great achievement of life as we know it is Berube's tone, informed, impassioned, and yet resolutely unsentimental. Family struggles of a different sort constitute the subject of Christopher Tillman's extraordinary debut novel, Mason's Retreat. Set in the late 1930s on a remote estate on Maryland's eastern shore, it's an eerie tale of one family's mad effort to reverse their failing fortunes. Tom DeHaven's exuberant novel, Derby Dugan's Depression Funnies, conjures up quite a different vision of the 1930s. It takes place in New York amidst the razzmatazz world of comic strip artists, bootleggers, and good-time girls, and tells an unexpectedly poignant story about friendship and professional loyalty. Part of the fun of reading Derby Dugan is stumbling across the names of real-life 30s personalities, like Peter Arno and Wallace Simpson. In Laurie R. King's just-published mystery, A Letter from Mary, we revisit a literary character who's made such an indelible impression on readers that many believe he actually existed. I'm speaking, of course, of Sherlock Holmes. A Letter from Mary is King's third mystery featuring the aging Holmes and his young wife, Oxford theologian Mary Russell, and it's a doozy. King somehow manages to preserve the integrity of Holmes's character and yet imagine a woman astute, edgy, and compelling enough to be his partner. Somewhere up in literary Valhalla, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is no doubt apoplectic over the liberties King has taken with his famous detective. But if you ask me, the love of a good, emancipated woman is just what Holmes needed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross. We've got another Christmas song to close with, one of the more unusual ones in this year's batch. It's not from a Christmas CD. It's from a new CD of singles produced by the late jazz composer Sun Ra. It's included on the collection Sun Ra, The Singles on Evidence Records. This is a vocal group called The Qualities, recorded in 1956.
Christmas time is Christmas time is Christmas time.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the children of incarcerated parents. We talk with Joyce Dixon. She spent 17 years in prison, knowing her two children were growing up without her. When she got out, she co-founded a group to help children whose parents are behind bars. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.